Whatever is inconsistent with the facts, no matter how fond of it we are, must be discarded or revised.
Humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that, without supernaturalism, affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity.
How do I define humanism? To me, it means, look, I'm good without God, and here are the different ways in which I'm good. It tells you that I have a moral code, an ethical code, that doesn't derive from religious holy books. It's a set of values that I live by.
In a nutshell, it's about leading a moral and ethical life.
But humanism's given a name to what I do believe in, which is that people are good.
The Owensboro Humanists.
All right, hello folks, and welcome to the Owensboro Humanist Podcast. I'm your host for tonight, Matt White, and joining me is Jordan Tong, of which we'll do introductions in a moment. The Owensboro Humanists are an American Humanist Association affiliate based in Owensboro, Kentucky, that provides a social haven for humanists, atheists, and agnostics in the Owensboro and surrounding areas. Before our discussion begins, we do have some announcements, however, and to find more specific details about these announcements, please join our Facebook group page at www.facebook.com/groups/OwensboroFreethinkers, or if you want some more details, you can always email us at OwensboroHumanists@gmail.com. But anyway, the announcements. On March 26th, the Owensboro Humanists will be showing up at the Owensboro Fairness Meeting at 6 p.m. The address is in the group page, so you can find it there. On Saturday, April 5th, we will be having a discussion at the Crim, and that's going to start at 4 p.m. On Saturday, April 19th, we're going to have our first family-friendly event, and that's going to be at the Museum of Science and History. We're hoping to kick that off by 2 p.m., and on Sunday, April 27th, volunteering at the Pinatino Shelter, we actually may be switching that time up from 4 p.m. to 12, but again, to keep on these ever-changing announcements, please join our Facebook page, or if you are not a humanist and you're interested in finding out more about how you can participate and volunteer, again, give us an email at owensborohumanists@gmail.com. So, tonight's podcast is kind of a trial podcast. It's the first of a two-part series titled Discussions with the Devout, which may become a long-term thing if this particular podcast is well-received. Tonight, we have with us Jordan Tong, and to give our listeners some perspective, Jordan and members from the Owensboro Humanists have engaged in sporadic discussion both online and in the Messenger Inquirer. We've had some very enjoyable discussions, some not so enjoyable, but we felt that instead of having these discussions inside of a closed group, it might be more beneficial and interesting to both of our respective audiences for us to talk about these issues in a very public way. Okay, so to give you guys an idea of how this discussion is going to work, we've each been given 3 to 5 minutes to introduce ourselves, roughly 10 minutes to talk about why we take our respective positions, and then a back and forth of question and answer. Aside from these general guidelines, it's going to be pretty conversational, and we hope you guys enjoy. Jordan and I have both prepared 3 questions for each other, so that means 6 in all, and we have allotted roughly 10 minutes to talk about each question after the initial person responds. Since Jordan is our guest today, he gets the first introduction, and he gets to take as much time as he needs within 2 to 3 minutes to give himself an intro and go from there. So go ahead, sir.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on on this, and I think it's a good discussion and an important one. So just a little bit about myself. I am 30 years old and married. Actually, today's my anniversary for 8 years, and I've got 3 kids.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. So I need to remember to get a gift for my wife before I go home today.
Right.
I graduated from Tennessee Tech University with a degree in civil engineering. So I kind of have a technical background, I guess. And after working in that field for just a little bit, I moved on to being a part of a family business. So now I'm a co-owner in a facility service contracting company. So that's kind of what I do by vocation. I'm obviously a Christian, which is the reason we're having this discussion. I'm a member at Pleasant Valley Community Church, which is a local church here in Owensboro. I consider that kind of part of my identity. And I blog occasionally at a website called athinkingchristian.com. So I have interest in some of these maybe more philosophical and cultural and political and economic type discussions as they pertain to worldviews. So yeah, I'm thankful to be on here and looking forward to the discussion.
All right, we're glad to have you. Most of you guys listening know who I am. I'm Matt White. Just to give you a little bit of background about myself, I started attending church when I was 5 up until about the age of 20 when, after studying my faith and leaving for college, I deconverted. I've got my bachelor's in history, and I'm working on a master's in library science right now. I was a genuine Christian. I believe the doctrines of Christianity on faith, but once I started examining it, that's when I stopped believing because I kind of no longer found it reasonable to hold that position. I started the Owensboro Humanists in 2012 as a way to bring unbelievers, humanists, and atheists together. We're steadily growing with roughly 200 members, and we always like the discussion. So after this podcast, if you want to ask questions or engage us, we'll post a link to our fan page below. Something I do have to say, I've had the opportunity to listen to Jordan's apologetics class that he taught, which I found on his blog, which I thought was very interesting. And we'll also post a link to that on our podcast site. So everybody's going to be quite linked up, so anyone listening can find both of our resources. I found myself agreeing with a lot of what Jordan said. I think, like Jordan, that the question of whether or not God exists is very, very important. If it is true, it should be accepted on reasonable grounds. I also believe that you should be willing to, as 1 Peter 3:15 says, defend your faith, or in my case, the lack thereof. I obviously disagreed on some of the things that he said, but one thing I do want to say real fast, us humanists don't believe there is a wrong way to question something. The whole skeptical scientific mindset is built on disproving ideas that lack evidence, accepting those ideas that have the most evidence to support them, and continually questioning and debating these ideas. Jordan and I agree that conversation and discussion in a congenial spirit is a good thing, and we both have a genuine interest in the topic, so I'm looking forward to the discussion. All right, so it's really up to you, Jordan. Would you like to do your opener first, or I can? It's up to you, man.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'll go ahead and go. It's the question basically is why am I a Christian, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe a little more about my spiritual background. I think just to be honest, I think there – obviously we're going to be talking about maybe the merits of Christianity or the lack thereof. But I think there's a lot of factors that go into why I'm a Christian. So I tried to outline those. I think there are 5 that maybe constitute all the reasons why I'm a Christian. I think first and foremost, probably not the most important, but I think it plays a big part, is just my upbringing and my family life. I think everybody's influenced to some degree by how they were raised, and I'm no different than that. So I was raised in a Christian home, and not just a nominal Christian home, but one where my parents lived out their faith, albeit imperfectly. But they were very authentic, so they weren't hypocrites in that sense, and so they taught me those things. And for a long time, that was sort of the basis of my belief, is what I had been taught. But that played a big part in what I believe now and why I'm a Christian now. All right. I think the second reason, outside of family and my upbringing, and let me just add one other thing to my upbringing. I guess being around other Christians who were authentic, specifically in my college years, being around guys that genuinely lived out their faith in a more holistic way. It was not just kind of this Sunday thing that we believed, but it really impacted their whole life. So there was definitely that aspect of being influenced by those I was around. I think a second aspect of it is just a social aspect. We're, as human beings, we're social creatures. And Christianity is not a solo religion. It's not like this kind of private thing you do, but it's a communal one. So when you become a Christian, you enter into the community called the church, and you live out your faith together. And being involved in a church, like I am at Pleasant Valley, with a lot of other genuine, authentic Christians, that is another, I guess, motivating factor. It's another reason for belief. And I think it's just kind of that old principle of you become like those that you hang around and are influenced by those. And so there's definitely a part of that where I am influenced by those that I spend time with. And probably the 3 most important reasons, the first one would be desires and needs. I think Christianity, for me, as I look at my life, as I look at my desires, my longings, things personally in me that I'm looking for fulfillment in or looking for answers for, Christianity meets those on a very personal level. So aside from all the maybe more rational or evidential-based things, there are certain needs and things that it fulfills. And to deny those, that would be foolish of me to say that. And just to point out a couple of those, I think joy and pleasure would be one. Christianity ultimately is for the joy and happiness of man and the glory of God. And I think that we're all looking for pleasure. We're all looking for joy in our lives. I think Christianity provides the ultimate means for making that happen. We're all looking for purpose, and Christianity offers a transcendent purpose. Things like justice, punishment for wrongdoing. We see all these things that are wrong with the world, and so often our whole political system is in all these debates that we have about, you know, same-sex marriage, and all these things are revolved around this idea of justice. And so there's a strong sense in that, and I think Christianity can make sense of that, and there's a very strong notion of justice built in. Things like love and forgiveness. I have faults and wrongs in my life, and there's guilt associated with that, and Christianity has a way of explaining that and also a way of dealing with that. And several other things that are on the desire level. So I think that's another component of my belief and why I'm a Christian. The fourth thing I think, and probably what we'll focus in most on today, is truth. I think that Christianity is true. As I got older, and specifically probably outside of college, I began to question maybe some of the underpinnings of my faith and why I believed what I believed. And really, to be honest, wrestled for a while about some of those things. I don't know that there was any specific one specific objection that was raised, but just really a general questioning on my part, kind of a coming into faith on my own and kind of owning my faith. And as I studied and as I researched, probably similar to what you have done, I was convinced that what I believed was true. It doesn't mean that I don't have questions. It doesn't mean that I don't have doubts. There are things that I still wrestle with. But I think all things considered, Christianity is the best option, and I think it is true. So my faith didn't necessarily start there, but it was affirmed through reason there. And that has obviously led me on one thing I did not mention. I'm currently working on a master's program as well in Christian apologetics, and that was kind of spawned out of a lot of these questions that I had. So, but that's been good and helpful, and it's made me enjoy this discussion. And I think the last thing, and I would be a poor Christian if I did not note this, and I think it's very true, is I think God is very real and has worked in my life. You know, all of this up to this point is somewhat could be reduced to maybe psychology or this or that. But I think there's a very real component of God convicting someone of sin, of showing someone the truth, and really working and changing somebody's life. And without getting into a whole discussion of exactly what that looks like and what that means, just looking at my life personally, and I think my wife is probably the best judge of my life and able to examine me. I think she would second just how I have radically been changed in the last few years because of my faith. And I think in large part of that, a lot of that I can't explain except for God's work in my life. So in a nutshell, I guess that's why I'm a Christian. And yeah, I think that's it, Matt.
Okay. I have to apologize to those out there. I do have a thing that I'm going to read because I'm very particular, and I feel like I had to put a lot of stuff into the opener here because my particular audience from the Owensboro Humanists are very familiar with Christians. A lot of them are former Christians. I don't know if it's so much true the other way around, how familiar that your audience, who's going to be mostly Christians, how familiar they are with atheists and humanists. So part of this, I have to dispel some rumors. So,
sure.
Bear with me. So as you've guessed on the question of whether or not the Christian God is real, I am an atheist. I'm an atheist concerning all gods because I hold them all to the same level of skepticism. To get this out of the way, atheism, I don't think, is a worldview. I don't know if Jordan and I will agree on that, but it's a position on one issue. So most atheists, they lack belief, but they do not assert definitively that there is no God. Atheism is a view in the negative, but my personal affirming philosophical outlook would be described as secular humanism. I just need to make the audience aware of those differences. In discussions about God, as in a discussion where anyone asserts a positive claim, it's the impetus of the person asserting the claim to provide evidence, and in any kind of discussion like this, it would fall on the person who says that there is a God. The skeptical mind always has the right and the option to weigh the evidence and to either accept it or reject it. The default, though, is to not have belief until given good reason to do otherwise. Just like I always ask folks, do you believe in fairies? They say no, and I ask why, and they say because you have no proof. And I agree, you are in your rights as a skeptic until proven otherwise. For our discussion, I've chosen three kind of overall reasons I don't believe in the Christian God. Generally, they are, number one, a lack of convincing evidence conclusively proving God's existence. The second one is the recognition that the Bible is one in a series of holy books, and it's kind of contradictory in form. And three, the observable world does not reconcile itself to the Christian God. It was hard to choose three, to be fair. There are many more, such as an infinite punishment for finite crime, that some folks feel that faith is gullibility, a lack of answered prayers, man is known to invent gods, belief is predicated on wishful thinking at times, there's a lack of miracles, there's a very strong similarity in Christianity to other mythologies, and the use of fear to motivate behavior. And that's just to name a few. So my lack of belief, I feel, is very, very grounded. First, to talk about the evidence for God's existence, I've never seen a conclusive, irrefutable, concrete argument that proves God's existence. Does that argument exist? Possibly. Have I personally seen it? No. And I'm skeptical until otherwise. Most arguments I've seen are philosophical in nature, and they only imply a God, usually as a way to kind of solve a problem, which I personally think is fallacious and does appeal to the God of the Gaps fallacy a lot. Many of the arguments I've seen, especially philosophical ones, haven't met what many skeptical individuals hold as a standard of evidence. Evidence and theories, they must be devoid of any logical fallacies, it must be logically consistent, and it must not rely on unknowns, or else they can be rejected. If there's no conclusive evidence for a question, and you'll probably hear me say this sometimes today, the proper response is, I don't know. I personally don't know if God exists. That's the agnosticism in me. And I don't believe it until shown otherwise. That's the atheist. And you can be both an agnostic and an atheist. They address two different things. To provide concrete examples, I've chosen just a couple of sub-arguments to consider and to show how they all have responses to them that kind of neuter any potency they have. We have the Kalam cosmological argument, but I think it rests on too many assumptions to favorably accept it, even as a starting premise for the possibility that God exists. When Jordan explained the argument in his apologetics video, I agree with him that the universe is finite, at least this universe is. A consideration of larger models involving multiple universes can call this into question. And the Kalam cosmological argument suffers from a simple kind of gods of the gaps fallacy that I think believers like to exploit. It can work with almost any deity you place in there. Allah could be the unmoved mover. So can the Baha'i faith's deity. Pick any that you want that meet the conditions. Even if the argument is true, to make the jump to the Christian God requires a sort of evidence that I don't think any of us really have. No one has claim to it. And so I think to kind of claim the Kalam cosmological argument as evidence for Christianity at the exclusion of others, I think it's kind of fallacious. I think you would have to have evidence that places the Judeo-Christian God above all others. And kind of moving away from philosophy, Jordan said a lot about emotion, and I'm very surprised how often conservative Christians actually do appeal to emotion. More skeptical minds are very weary of this, just because emotional ploys don't really set well as true statements. There's a popular argument out there by William James, which is kind of the will to believe idea, and it's an emotional argument that I've heard a lot, that all people inherently know God because of a feeling or an insight they get that is somehow innate. Individuals who grow up as atheists or pantheists with no concept of God apart from an abstract idea prove this to be kind of inaccurate. Belief in a monotheistic God is taught. Second, I get to move towards the book that's probably going to be much in question tonight, the Bible. I'm familiar enough with the Bible to know that it's a holy book, that while having some unique elements to it, I don't think it stands as either infallible or inerrant, so I think you have to scrutinize it accordingly. Jordan and I have both studied it, and I grant you, Jordan, you're probably far more knowledgeable in it than I am, because you actively defend it. I'm no expert, but I recognize the real problems the book has, and I've considered the apologetic arguments that attempt to explain them away. Many issues to me just cannot be reconciled, and the biblical doctrine of it being a perfect book I don't think can reasonably be supported in this light. To make a basic point, it's a book that's been translated, edited, contains mistakes across manuscripts, and not just small ones, but mistakes big enough to mar the whole meanings behind passages, and that can change theology. There are contradictions, numerical ones, chronological ones, and theological ones that can't be reasonably explained by, you know, me interpreting it wrong. It portrays a lot of fantastical stories similar to other mythologies of the time. The composition of the Bible is naturally explained. The books were voted upon in committee, with others not fitted being excluded. And influences of individual stories can be traced back to older mythologies that clearly influenced the authors. Some examples. Noah's story is based on an older Mesopotamian author. El, which is what you call God in the Old Testament, specifically in the Pentateuch, he is based on a Canaanite god. Jesus himself, at least the legendary Jesus, maybe not so much the historical one, is kind of an amalgamation of previous faith traditions. I just don't think that a lot of these things can be ignored when understanding and reading the Bible. And Thomas Paine points out something in his Age of Reason that really, really did it for me. It's absurd, Thomas Paine thought, to use a book to relay divine messages because both written and spoken human language, they're subjected to the types of change that are kind of unreliable vehicles. They change the meaning of text and messages on throughout the age. And this is shown in the Bible as well. We have the problem of, you know, the vagueness of some text lacking clarity. I think the Bible, with all these flaws, and many that I skipped over, can't reasonably assert it to be the tool of an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good, and above all, perfect God who would resort to kind of such imperfect means to communicate with his creation. And the last point, I promise I will shut up after this, we come to God in the observable world, and I must mention in passing the fact that biological evolution, for me, pretty much nixes the idea of the Bible being 100% literal. As there being no literal seven-day creation in Adam and Eve, then there's no need for a literal fall, thus there's no need for Jesus to redeem people. I think conservative Christians have it dead right on that, and I understand why evolution is very much a threat to Christian belief, because it's very hard to reconcile the first chapter, or the first couple of chapters with Genesis, with the evolutionary account. The world is undeniably older than what biblical literalists and young earth creationists contend, and, you know, this does away with me for at least Genesis being literally true. Of course, I've got problems with the problem of evil. I think Epicurus handled that very well. Conservative Christians believe that God is all-knowing, all-good, and all-powerful, and considering the world around us, I don't believe that their Christian God can exist allowing evil in the world under these conditions. Christian theology has a difficult time dealing with this. You know, they postulate God's preference for free will, but if you accept this argument, I think you accept that God is at least tacitly okay with evil to a degree, voiding him being all good. If he created the world knowing the pain and evil that would not come from it, or that would come from it, he's not all good. If he didn't know, he's not all-knowing. If he knew and didn't step in, he's not all-good and or all-powerful. Christians point to the sacrifice of Jesus as the solution, that God did in fact step in, but does it ethically or logically make sense to sacrifice yourself to yourself because you allowed something you created, Satan, to ruin something else you created? I don't think God can escape culpability in the Christian story. When you break it down to its most simple elements, it appears to me more man-made mythology lacking cohesion than a real credible explanation for God's role in the world. I don't think God can meet the Christian definition that conservative Christians place upon him. Overall, I have many more reasons, I just don't have time for them. In the face of a lot of these reasons, and in logic, and I have to say that I think I use the same mental faculties that Jordan uses. I don't find any good reason to accept the Christian God. I do agree with Jordan that Christianity offers some answers. So does secular humanism. Both attempt to address the same issues, that they address morality, consciousness, meaning, purpose, etc. But I think where Christianity falls short is it often appeals to God and, you know, mysteries, the unknown, as a special plug for what we can't answer. Humanists, you know, we're not afraid to admit when we don't know, so appealing to God, I don't think, provides anything conclusive in these areas, where other viewpoints or religions can't, so in light of that, I have to reject it. That's what I've got. I gave you a lot to work with, Jordan, so hopefully it gives both of our listeners something to think about.
Yeah.
In that note, you don't have to listen to me much longer, at least in terms of how we're going to go about this. Who wants to ask the first question?
Let's see. I guess we had arranged it where I'll pose the first question to you. Here we go. The first question I have is on an atheistic worldview, and again, one of the things I don't want to do is build any sort of straw man argument against you, so correct me if I'm making any mischaracterizations of you. But on an atheistic worldview, how can you account for the existence of the universe? And you'd mentioned the Kalam and all that kind of stuff. And let me just explain briefly what I mean by universe. I mean everything that exists. So the entire natural order. Mm-hmm. So space, time, matter, energy, and so by using that characterization of the universe, I mean multiverse, whatever you want to call it, everything that involves the natural world.
The whole shebang.
The whole shebang, yeah.
The whole shebang,
so,
okay.
So just maybe in my mind, the way I see this, and then maybe you can respond here, is it seems to me that there are only two options. And one is that the universe is eternal, which in my mind, and we can discuss this after you give your answer, that it seems to pose some scientific and philosophical issues there. Mm-hmm. And two, that the either it's eternal or the universe just popped into existence uncaused out of nothing. Okay. And so it seems to me that number one appears false and number two appears absurd. And so I want to hear how, on your worldview, you can account for and make sense for this.
Okay. Once again, as a humanist, I have to be able to say that sometimes we just don't know. That will be at least accounted for part of this answer. Whenever you say the atheistic worldview, I don't know if it's accurate to say that the atheistic worldview accepts this or not. I don't want to conflate atheism with science. There are some people who don't believe in God that are very unscientific in how they approach this, how they approach things. So I'm going to assume that by atheistic you mean how does a scientific worldview?
Yeah, maybe a naturalistic worldview maybe is maybe a more accurate term.
Sure. When you talk about naturalism. When you talk about science, follows what's called methodological naturalism. It's basically the presupposition, and it's a free presupposition. You can argue whether it's a good one or not, but it's a presupposition that basically science cannot appeal to supernatural means as explanations. There was a time whenever it could, but we found that using science and not applying supernatural means to it yields better results because you keep asking those questions and you keep pushing back the frontiers further and further. So I personally adhere to the scientific method, which adheres to methodological naturalism, and it doesn't suppose supernaturalism. So in my explanation, we don't suppose that there are supernatural elements to explain nature. Now, could there be? It's quite possible, but it's not something that we automatically jump to in order to provide an explanation. As far back as it goes, I believe the Big Bang Theory, as well as the cosmic evolution of elements, stars, and planets, best explain our current reality. We're a product of processes that have taken a very long time and a certain combination of resources. I believe our universe began with the non-complex, which evolved into complexity, which actually happens all the time. It is observable. We know how certain elements can be molded by stars and their environments into other elements, which can be then molded again into other elements. You know, things don't necessarily spontaneously come into creation. You're working with what you already have. We know the mechanisms that explain how it all got here. This is all backed up by good observational evidence, by the way. I mean, this is stuff you can go look up, or that anyone can go look up. To talk about the Big Bang, just real fast, if anyone tells you that the Big Bang is something coming from nothing, they are lying to you. That is because the Big Bang does not talk about anything up until right at the point where it's an expansion. The Big Bang is a misnomer anyway. It's an expansion. But the point that I'm trying to make is those who believe in the Big Bang do not say that something comes from nothing. That's a complete falsity. And to answer the question that you posed, you know, where did it all come from? I took your question to mean, you know, where does the universe itself come from? Just our universe. That doesn't necessarily rule out other universes. It doesn't necessarily rule out, you know, multiple universes that could be in an infinite state of flux, of Big Bang collapse, back and forth, back and forth. I know you're familiar with this idea. Mm-hmm. To answer what caused the Big Bang and why are we here, I think they're philosophical questions because science doesn't really – it can't tell you either one of these things, especially what caused the Big Bang, because we just cannot look back that far. And I say that with a hesitancy that we might be able to one day. I just find that there are a lot of severe mischaracterizations of the Big Bang Theory. Like, it doesn't violate the law of the conservation of mass energy because it doesn't come from something from nothing. I don't know. To me, it's logically consistent in as much as it accounts for the evidence. I think that believing in a deity, which is logically inconsistent, violates moral laws and ideas about cause and effect. By saying that something can be created out of nothing, because even a deity is a form of something. So I don't think it can be logically stated that nothing creates something on either side of the field.
Okay, yeah, let me make two points.
Sure.
And let me make the first one, and I'll give you a chance to respond to it. I think I'm going to disagree with when you say science is based on philosophical naturalism. I think that that is a you did say it is a presupposition that you bring to the table.
I didn't say philosophical, methodological.
What's that?
Methodological. There's a difference.
Okay, that's right. I apologize. I had it wrong in my notes here. I misrecorded here. But I think that science ultimately is a search for causes and a search for truth. And I think, and I'm with you, that we do assume natural causes. But there are certain fields of science that are looking for causes which are agency causes. So fields like archaeology or things in that nature, they're looking for things that are that show signs of some sort of agent involved in some sort of process. And so if there was no agency in the world, then obviously we could resort to purely methodological naturalism. But if there is agency, then we have to at least leave that as a possibility that something is on the table. And I think most historical scientists, you mentioned Kepler and or Copernicus and Galileo and Newton and Boyle and all these guys that were Christians or believers in some sense, did not subscribe to this methodological naturalism. So I feel like that's maybe more of a modern concept that I think I would have to disagree with. I don't think it has a good warrant for it. And feel free to respond there if you want.
But I would ask you why it doesn't, just as a principle, as a way of working through science, why does it not work? Because my objection to that would be, okay, so if you assume that there is some kind of agency that caused something, what specifically sets your preferred agency apart from, say, another preferred agency? What sets, say, Allah apart from Christianity? I know ideas, intelligent designers, they do talk about there possibly being an agency that is involved in the entire creation of the world. They're very picky about their terms.
But sure, they are.
Yes, they are. And for good reason. I understand why.
Yes.
But
they walk a fine line. I get that.
Yes.
And actually, to be honest with you, Matt, you mentioned this in your intro. I agree with you, actually. I don't think that really – I don't think almost any natural theology project by trying to prove God from some sort of deduction from observations in nature can prove the Christian God. I'm in total agreement with you there.
Okay.
I think at the most it can give us maybe some ideas about what the agency or the causal agent is like, maybe powerful or immaterial or that sort of thing. But I don't think, and it can give us, you know, hints of this looks like the Christian God or whatever. But you're right. That's not enough information to help you distinguish between Allah and the God of the Bible.
I guess my question to you in follow up would be, as a Christian, what, I guess, and I don't want to sound obnoxious when I say this, but what gives you kind of precedence or right to claim that as some type of evidence for God? Because apologists do it all the time. And I'm very curious about that. Like, what explains the disconnect between, you know, folks admitting that, okay, we can't necessarily apply, you know, Yahweh over Allah, but at the same time, this is still fairly decent evidence. Like, it seems almost like a slippery slope, like it's almost like grasping at straws. Maybe you can correct me on that.
Yeah, and trying to understand the question. Well, I think that, you know, so we'll just use Muslims as an example. So I think that we are involved in somewhat of the same project in, I guess, justifying our theism. But that's such a broad claim that we're not getting into any sort of theological questions about God and his character and who he is and that sort of thing. So I think when someone's using natural theology to prove God, if you will, to use that word, I think what they're trying to do is very modest, I guess. And so, yeah, it could be a slippery slope and people can abuse it. And I think a lot of apologists do abuse it, to be honest with you. And to be honest with you, I'm guilty of that myself. I have done that in the past.
Yeah, that's one thing that we as skeptics hold a lot of folks who necessarily buy into, like, paganism or pantheism. They try to do that as well, establish some kind of solid link between maybe something as simple as perceived design in the world, or they try to build some kind of link between, well, I've got this good philosophical argument here, and my God works for that, so, you know, checkmate, atheist. You know, we run into that a lot as unbelievers.
Right. And sure, I get you. Well, let me ask, here's the main gist of my question, and I guess what I want to do is just kind of press on you a little bit on this original cause? Because in my mind, it seems like they're in principle. So regardless of what the science is, regardless of what we can find out, I think it's so cool that we do all this cosmology and hopefully we can find out more about it. It's super interesting. Mm-hmm. But all of that aside, there's ultimately only two options. You either have something that popped into existence out of nothing, what you said doesn't happen, it's absurd, and I agree with you, it's mm-hmm. logically absurd. Or you have some sort of eternal universe. So you have something that has existed eternally. Mm-hmm. And those seem to be the only two options. And to me, the idea of existing eternally, which is the position I'm assuming that you take, that there was something that existed eternally, it just seems like there's lots of problems with that.
Right.
And maybe I just a couple of ones to point out, and you probably know this from the class that I taught. So one would be the impossibility of infinity, mm-hmm. of there being an actual infinite number of events, the idea of reaching an infinity through successive addition mm-hmm. Is another one. Why are we at the point we are now? Why did we not reach it an infinite amount of time ago? There's just lots of absurdities when it comes to infinity. Mm-hmm. So issues like that. Why, if there were things were eternal, why did it not? Why did the things that all the mechanisms that caused the Big Bang, why did they not happen an infinite amount of time ago? It just seems like there's all sorts of issues, even with the amount of energy available and all this kind of stuff. And I had a quote, and a lot of atheist physics professors, there's just kind of that conundrum, and I'm sure you're aware, you know, people like Alex Vilenkin and guys like that, you know, they're really trying to find a way to have an eternal universe, but it seems like all the evidence that keeps coming in says this thing started somewhere, regardless of if you have a multiverse or whatever. So I guess I just want to kind of press you on that point and maybe see kind of how you handle that.
One thing you said real fast, you said regardless of the science, I don't think that's a good idea to say that, just because you have to follow where the evidence leads you. You know, you said the word conundrum, and I think that aptly describes it. This is where I'm not afraid or ashamed to give the response I mentioned earlier that, you know, anyone with intellectual integrity, they should be willing to give this response. And that response is, I don't know. So, I mean, that's the answer I have to give you and your audience. I mean, I'm completely aware of folks far more qualified than myself to discuss this topic, because these are huge issues, and I'm also completely aware that I can't give you an answer that will satisfy both you or your audience. I will completely admit that.
No, I'm with you. Well, let me just make it one closing comment on this, and maybe we can move on, and you can finish it out, and then we can move on to something else. I guess where my issue lies, and I guess what I, in my mind, is a weakness of I won't use atheistic worldview, but that naturalistic thinking is that it does seem to forever punt the question, because it does seem in principle to not have an answer unless you posit something, an eternal something. And ultimately, that whatever that eternal something is kind of functions as this as God in some senses. And so it seems to me that because the existence of the universe is the most fundamental core thing about reality, I mean, it's the first thing we know about ourselves, is that we exist, and to forever not have an answer to that seems to be, I guess, missing out on the most important part of reality and understanding what reality is about. And so to me, that seems like a big weakness or a big vulnerability, something that kind of this huge gap that you're always going to have to live with.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and say this in an attempt to kind of wrap things up, but forgive me, this may be a little long. You know, you give the word conundrum, and I think that aptly describes the original question, as well as, you know, I could ask a similar question, how can a Christian God account for all that we see here? Because that point of view does have issues of its own. I guess I would have to fundamentally disagree with you that my response is evasive as much as it's honest. And I completely understand the need to have an answer to this question, how did it all begin? And I understand that Christianity does provide an answer to this question that I can't. But I would ask, you know, what's the quality of that answer? You asked the question to me, so I didn't get a chance to critique the Christian response to the question, which, you know, could be done all day. But here's the thing. I think the brutal reality of it is we have to both say, I don't know. Your faith then can carry you from there, but I don't make any leap beyond the admission of my own ignorance. You and I both recognize that this question is something that science may not be able to answer, at least for now. And I know that it'll grate on the ears of your audience when I say that might just be the reality of it. However, as someone who's a humanist who believes that this does reflect reality, you know, most of us humanists don't accept this in such a defeatist attitude. We take this to give us the reason to fund scientific endeavors, to keep looking and to keep searching. You know, you say that we keep punting the issue, but is the admission of ignorance a punt? I don't think so. If I can't answer a calculus question, am I punting it when I say I don't know? Then I don't think I am. We both recognize that an infinite and finite universe pose their own different problems. For the infinite universe, the problem of infinity can be a real challenge. For the finite universe, what was the cause? These are issues we can't resolve in 15 minutes, aside from just giving our respective views and why we think that way. You know, we're talking about something very complex that, for all intents and purposes, is really guesswork until we have something more concrete to discuss what happened before the Big Bang. So, to answer your original question, I choose the scientific response because, sure, it doesn't give me the satisfaction that I'm, you know, the apple of God's eye or that I'm special, but it does take into account the nature of reality as we know it. And I guess, to finally wrap things up, I want to warn against your particular listeners, as well as my own, to claim this as kind of like an argumentative victory one way or another. Now, just because I'm honest enough to say that I don't know doesn't mean we can jump to the supernatural explanation. Because any alternative explanation offered due to my ignorance on this, it must have some type of empirical proof of its own to validate it. You know, we can't substitute a theological mystery to solve a mystery. And I'd rather just say I don't know than to adopt a position that sounds good, and that does answer the question, but it may be completely the wrong answer. I want to avoid making the mistake of accepting a possible mythology that could be wrong, instead of, you know, just admitting I don't know and being willing to wait for the right answer. I'm sorry, we do have to wrap up this topic because we went a little bit over on our time, so unfortunately we'll have to get you to ask the next question. Sorry to push us along, and I know we could talk about it a lot more, but we got to keep moving. To you, what is the most compelling evidence for God, in your opinion?
I'll break down my answer into basically three things, starting with a very general and working into a more specific into the Christian God. I think that that belief in God is what I would call, or what others have called, a properly basic belief. So, and what I mean by that is all of our beliefs are either, they're either basic or they're non-basic, and by that I mean either you have them. So, like, basic beliefs are things that you don't believe on the basis of something else. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, so like your memory beliefs, those aren't based on anything else. Your belief that the external world is real, your belief that what your senses are telling you, those are all basic beliefs. And we have a number of basic beliefs. I think a lot of things we believe, basically, we believe a lot of things on authority, just daily by, you know, reading the newspaper or reading a history textbook or learning something from our professor or what have you. You know, we've been talking about cosmology, and a lot of what we're quoting is just based on the authority of scientists, you know. And so a lot of beliefs that we have aren't based upon anything else, but they're essentially basic beliefs. And then we have other beliefs that are based on those beliefs. And I think belief in God ultimately is a basic belief. I think it's something that most people often come to apart from the whole apologetic enterprise. I think people, when their faculties are working correctly, they come to form a belief in God based on different things, whatever certain conditions, maybe observing, you know, a beautiful sunset or a newborn baby. And people have these impulses towards believing in God. And I think, so in that sense, I think belief in God is properly basic. And Alvin Plantinga, who's, I'm sure you're familiar with who he is,
Oh, yeah.
A philosophy professor, heads the department at Notre Dame, and Nicholas Wolterstorff at Yale University philosophy department. They've kind of pioneered this field. And it really kind of goes along with what the Bible says, that everybody is born with what John Calvin called the sensus divinitas, a sense of God. And so I think ultimately my belief in God, and this is probably not very satisfying for you, I understand that, but it's really just a basic belief in him. Like, I just believe. And I don't think in order for me to be rational, I don't think it has to be based upon anything else. Now, I'll talk about some evidences here in just a second. But I think it's just a basic belief. And I think if you go around the world and you mention the word God, like, everybody knows exactly what you're talking about, because that belief is very easily formed, and it seems to be basic to most humanity. Mm-hmm. You can go to the most remote tribe in the most remote part of the world, and they have a concept of God. So, and, you know, yeah, obviously you may have some other explanations for that, but I think it is a basic belief. So that's probably the main reason. The second thing is natural revelation. And we talked about this just briefly with cosmology, but I think that, so upon having that basic belief, I think there are other things in nature or in the world and the reality around us that that I guess would, you would call pointers to God or clues to God, I guess, that would maybe give you a rational basis for affirming that basic belief that you have. Mm-hmm. So you talked about earlier, you know, you can't use the cosmological argument to reason yourself to God, and I totally agree with that. I think people start with a belief in God, almost maybe you could call it a presupposition or a basic belief, and then things like natural theology, so cosmological arguments or fine-tuning arguments or moral arguments, those things are reasoned arguments that maybe that would confirm the presupposition that you have. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to those, I would point to, you know, the argument that we've been talking about cosmology. I think that, although, again, it doesn't prove everything for me, I think it definitely points in that direction, and it provides confirmation for the belief in God that I have. It's definitely not antagonistic towards it. The same for the fine-tuning, and we can get into what fine-tuning is. I think right. C.S. Lewis talked about an argument from desire, which I think is fairly powerful. I think the moral argument, and we'll get into that, so I won't belabor that point, I think points to one. And one, for me as an engineer and a guy that's been heavily involved in math and calculus and all that good stuff, you know, mathematical arguments. I think that one of the things that's really interesting is that our physical world can be described by mathematical realities. So you have like these, it's almost like math is the language or the blueprint that the physical world is written in. And there was a famous essay written by, I think, Eugene Wilder that talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the physical world. And there's no good explanation for why we can intelligibly understand the world through these mathematical concepts in our brains. And it just makes sense that that comes from a rational, some other rational source. So those things are pointers to God. Maybe they're confirmations for me. So if I ever doubt or have questions, those things maybe serve as confirmations. And for some people, like C.S. Lewis, they've been convincing for them. Mm-hmm. But again, all this up to this point, I don't think gets you all the way to Christianity. And so in all reality, and I think you have to would agree with this, that if we were to know God, just like if we were to know any person, he would have to reveal himself. And if he didn't tell us about himself or reveal himself to us or show himself to us, like we would have no idea. We'd be left to blind speculation. Mm-hmm. And you've pointed that out. You're right. You'd just be left to philosophizing about things, you know. And so I think that ultimately Christianity is based on God revealing himself. And I guess in two ways specifically. One is through the Bible, which is basically, and we'll get into that later too, but a story of God's interaction with the world. And I think most specifically in the person of Jesus. So, and I think this is part of what sets Christianity apart from some of the other religions, if you study those, and I'm sure you have, that you have God actually interacting with people and actually coming to be with them in the person of Jesus. So I guess those more special revelation things of the scriptures and specifically of Jesus. I mean, really, that's the whole central point of my faith. I mean, if he's not real, did not rise from the dead, then it's all a sham in my mind. So really, those are the, I guess, the pinnacle of the reasons that I would believe in God.
Okay. I tried to follow you and make like a little list as you were talking.
There's a whole smattering of things. So.
I know, and there's so much here that we could talk about. One thing I kind of want to say, especially for your first point, as someone who's skeptical, I have to warn individuals to be very careful about wanting to believe in something. And I speak from this personally just because I really, really wanted to believe in Christianity. I wanted to believe in God and I wanted to believe in Jesus. I wanted to reaffirm my faith, but the evidence pointed me the absolute other way. You know, magicians, con artists, they definitely prey on what we want to believe, but that doesn't necessarily make it so. You talked about basic beliefs and that you think that the belief in God is a basic belief, but I would also ask you, what are some other basic beliefs that are very possibly not true? The belief in afterlife, perhaps. A lot of evidence has shown that that's just not the case. I mean, if you read into near-death experiences, if you read into, you know, actual testimonies of people who have died and come back, if you study the neurology of it, if you study, you know, what it takes to die, if you get a morbid fascination with death like I've had, because I find it a very interesting topic, you'll understand that there's more than likely not an afterlife. And that's a very, very basic belief that people have, that the evidence is leaning towards, no, we actually do not have one. So I would question what a basic belief is, just in that it sounds very familiar to that will to believe that William James talks about, and he was very popular for making that kind of a movement back. I believe it was in the mid-late to 1800s. Mm-hmm. Just because you want to believe something, just because it appeals to everything emotionally to you, doesn't necessarily make it true. You have to be very careful about believing something just because you want to, or just because it seems innate. That's why you have to question the very things that are innate. So basic beliefs are very, very slippery. I think in part of what you said, you also kind of appeal to an argument from popularity, in that if you go around the world, most people believe in God. You know, I don't want to sound rude, but so, you know, an argument from popularity is a logical fallacy that just because it's popular, that means it's true. There have been loads of things in the past that have been popular that are very untrue. You also talked about observing bad things, or sorry, you talked about, you know, observing all the good things in life and seeing God, you know, speaking through nature. I would ask you, what about the bad things? What about the worm that burrows into the eye of the child in Africa, and that's the only way that it can survive? What about the death and the destruction and the things that I guess that a lot of Christians would say, well, that's the result of a fallen world, that's the result of sin. I think that whenever you talk about these natural pointers to God, I think that that's having a very, very sunny and unrealistic view of the world, because the world is not inherently good or evil. Nature is not inherently good or evil. Nature has good things that happen in it, at least, you know, what we would extrapolate as good. Nature has some bad things that happen into it, you know, the things that we would call evil.
Let me just interject real quick, man, just to clarify.
Yes, and so go ahead.
Make sure we're not talking past each other. Yeah. I don't think that just because a majority of people believe in God, that makes this idea that it's properly basic true. So I guess I was maybe looking at that more as that maybe confirms my hypothesis that it's basic. That's not necessarily using it to posit that. And I guess the other thing too, and I don't mean that just because. Basically, the whole point in saying this is I'm trying to point out the fact that it is rational for someone to believe in God as a properly basic belief, based on seeing things, having experiences or whatever, that belief is naturally produced. And that's not to say that there can't be defeaters for it. So you could say you're irrational for holding that because of the problem of evil or because of this or that. So I definitely think that's on the table, but I'm just saying it's not irrational for someone to have that basic belief unless it can be shown to be irrational. Does that make sense?
Saying that it is irrational to hold the belief, or talking about whether it's rational to hold the belief, doesn't necessarily address the issue of whether or not it's rational in light of these facts to still hold on to that belief.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Yes. So maybe on the backside of my belief, you could come at me and say, it's irrational for you to believe in God because of ABC. Right. Now, I don't think that you can say I'm irrational initially for holding that belief, but if you can show me, you know, it's kind of like a mirage. Like at the beginning, you see the trees and you see the water or whatever, but it turns out that basic belief, which you are rational for holding, but it can be proved to be false. And so kind of in the same sense, you could potentially show me that it's irrational.
Right. Well, what's defined as rational to one person is very different to what's defined as rational to another. And that's actually one of the questions that you ask further down the line.
Proofs are very person relative.
Yes. What is rational for me is definitely something that adheres to the scientific method. What's rational for some people is religious revelation. That's fine, but, you know, whether or not it's rational, that can be debated. Does it actually reflect the truth? Does it actually work? Does it give you insight into how the world works? Can it be proven? You know, what is rational? You have to set up the definitions on what rational is. And that being said, I don't know if I agree with you completely that it's rational to believe these things. I think it's a good starting point, especially if it's taught, because as I said before, I believe that belief in God is taught. Belief in some kind of overarching power is definitely taught, because you have stark examples of kids who have not been raised in a monotheistic tradition. They do not hold that belief at all. They don't have that basic belief. So I think that's a real serious problem to the idea that the belief in God is a basic belief at all.
So maybe a couple points there. I think that as far as it being irrational, and you disagreeing, maybe we can dialogue about that. I think that you would need to show on the back end that my belief in that is irrational, based on maybe some incoherence in my belief, or something that's contradictory, because we all have starting points. I mean, you have a starting point of the scientific method, of skepticism, of empiricism, and to be honest, all of these are very unprovable things. They're basic beliefs for you. They're starting points, and I think they're self-referentially incoherent. I think they refute themselves. They can't stand under the own weight of their own standards. And so I think you would have to apply some sort of criticism to my system to show that it is irrational.
Well, I'm glad we got that out on the table, because I honestly believe that a theistic view of the world, it can't stand up under the weight of scrutiny as well. So we both, let's talk about the elephant in the room. We don't agree that the other person's presuppositions that they bring are tenable ones. That's on the table. We both know that. That being said, my position is that we have to work with what we know, and to appeal to supernaturalism and to appeal to, you know, theism, I would rather be okay with talking about the isms that are logically sometimes not as consistent as we like them to be, than to have to sacrifice any kind of skepticism and say that it works in the context of, like, a supreme lawgiver or something like that.
What do you mean by no? So you're making an epistemological claim of we only should deal with the things that we know, as if there's this certain body of knowledge that we all know. I think it's important, because you're making the claim that I can't know that God exists, or that, you know, this or that, that you can know that skepticism is the best way, or empiricism is true. So I guess maybe what are the grounds for making those sorts of assertions?
Okay, you and I have both publicly on Facebook discussed the merits of empiricism, and I recognize the flaws that you've pointed out both publicly and on this podcast. I agree that empiricism by itself is self-referential, and, you know, you find it self-defeating. Again, I kind of agree. Just by itself, it is. This is noted, so, you know, I grant you that point, that empiricism by itself isn't all that, but I don't think one can know things empirically just by itself, but I think empiricism makes a good case in validating other types of isms. Rationalism, as opposed to empiricism, has its flaws as well. You know, if you were just solely to believe in rationalism, while it's abstract and logically consistent, you know, it can't be said to work unless there's some kind of evidence to validate it, which it has to appeal to empiricism to do so. So I don't think empiricism and rationalism are inconclusive, and I'm willing to admit that. When we discussed this the first time around, I was very ignorant of epistemology. I still somewhat am, but I choose empiricism over rationalism first, but I would hope they would reinforce each other. And I kind of say this to head off a potential debate over, you know, what it is to know epistemology, because, yes, I completely agree with you that you're on your stance that empiricism by itself does have flaws. And, you know, I'll admit this publicly. Whenever you and I debated this before, I admit that, you know, after looking at it, you actually changed my mind on this point. And I think it's very unwise to embrace that sole empirical stance. But I think it's the best one to appeal to if you have to exclude the others. But, you know, to know what it is to know, I think it's more complex than just adhering to one ism that, you know, you prefer over another.
Yeah. I think it is an important point that we're talking about this, because I think some of our major differences are our starting points. And I think that really does, it's really the ultimate reason for where we part ways. So I think that when you talk about evidence and you talk about proofs, and first of all, certainty is more of a psychological state, this 100% sort of thing. And so I don't think anyone can ever know anything beyond a shadow of a doubt with no room for doubting. I mean, Descartes tried to do that, and with his, you know, his famous maxim. And I think that's, yes. I think philosophers have driven themselves crazy trying to to entertain the certainty question, but that doesn't mean that we can't know things. And I guess here's my problem. I think with a starting point of empiricism, of saying you can only know what you can observe with your five senses, which I'm assuming that's a fair characterization of your view, and then kind of basing everything else upon that via deduction or induction or whatever, I think that that limits things and takes away things that we do know. I think you're creating a knowledge scenario or a system of knowledge. For one, empiricism doesn't – you can't prove empiricism via empiricism, so which means that it's self-referentially incoherent. But also there's other things that we know, like the belief in other minds, you know, that you're not just a robot in there, but there's really a guy named Matt White in there that's interacting with me, or your memory beliefs, you can't prove those scientifically, or belief that the external world is real, or mathematical truths, or the belief that it's, you know, it's wrong to torture little children for fun. You know, those are moral issues that can't be proved scientifically. But I think we know those things. And so to set up a system that eliminates all that knowledge for the sake of, you know, science or whatever, I think is – I just think it's not a wise thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you that trying to prove empiricism with empiricism can be faulty. You know, like I said, you changed my mind on that one, because I agree. After looking at the issue, you don't want to use – I don't know if you would want to use rationalism to try to just, you know, to prove rationalism as well. So I think they can all be, you know, self-defeating in kind of a way. I mean, I would hope all of our isms kind of complement each other one way or another, in as much as hopefully they don't contradict each other too much. And to give a hint to the moral question that you kind of brought up, I think you scientifically can prove something is morally wrong by looking to see what measurable effects it has on someone. So I think empiricism can be applied to morality, but that's a story for further down the line. However, like I said, I concede some of your points on using empiricism just by itself. I prefer it over rationalism. You know, I feel like I've explained it fairly well, but we really do have to get back on track.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right there. I think I think what you said is spot on, that it is much more complex. Knowing and knowledge is much more complex than just our senses, and we do come to know a lot of things by a lot of different ways. And so I would put belief in God in that category, which is kind of how we got off on this rabbit trail here.
Yeah, so you're more of a rationalist.
So I think that you know, maybe you would not start there, and that's fine. I think you're rational, at least in some degree, on that point, and we can debate whether or not my view is rational or your view is rational. But I think it's rational for both of us to start with the presuppositions that we have. So I can close out there. That's fine.
That's fine. Yeah, to say that somebody walks into a conversation without a presupposition is to blatantly lie. So
sure, absolutely. Yeah, question two for you. And this will get into the morality thing, so which should be a good discussion here. So apart from God as the ground for morality, or apart from some transcendent source, how can you account for objective moral values and duties? And I realize that you probably don't hold to that, so I guess assuming that you don't hold to objective morals, I guess the question becomes, is there anything more to morality than preference or utility? Either morals are there, they're objective, certain things are objectively right or wrong, and you can say it in the Platonic sense or whatever, but there is some transcendent morality there, or it's just purely preference and used as a power play or for utility or whatever you want to call it. So I guess, how do you make sense of morality in the world? Because we do live in a moral universe, if you will. It's very much part of the fabric. You can't hardly have a conversation with someone and not use the words should or ought. You know, any political discussion is just laden with moral claims and statements about what people ought to do. And so I guess, how do you account for that kind of thing?
A moral universe, I understand in the way that you're saying it. I took it as a very literal sense. I think the universe exists completely independent of our morality. But I understand in what context you were saying it. I just wanted to clear that up in case someone took it both ways. So, obviously atheism doesn't really make a statement on morality aside from the God aspect, you know, but it makes no positive statements. Atheists can believe in I mean, a million different types of morality. It's not just a battle between subjective and objective morality. Those are not just the only two options that someone can choose. You know, you have objective morality. You could be a consequentialist. You can just base your moral code on what are the consequences. You can be a utilitarian. You can say what helps the most people. You could be a subjectivist, which, you know, is kind of what you were leaning towards. You know, what works for you, and what works for me. I don't buy that at all. At least not in the sense that I think you presented it. You can also believe in Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative, you know, which is act only according to the maxim whereby you can at the same time. Well, that it should become universal law. I think morality can be observed to be three things. First off, it's complex. That's why we have the field of ethics to study it. And we're not going to hash it out in 15 minutes. That's we're going to admit that right there. We're not going to hash this out. I think that there is a biological basis for morality, and I think understood in the context of biological evolution, morality can be explained by the benefit of our species and individuals. Whether or not there is an objective morality, you can definitely play with the idea that maybe it's biological. Incest, excessive murder, rape, theft, they're not good for the social structures needed to propagate the species. If you talk about an objective morality, I think biology definitely has to be tied into it. And the third thing that I'm going to talk about, it may sound a little self-contradictory, but this is where I'm coming from. Morality to me is an idea. It's an idea in the same way as freedom's an idea, that government's an idea, that society is an idea. But that does not in any way degrade morality or ethics. Ethics are a set of rules that we live by in the same way that politics is a set of rules that we govern by. But recognizing that neither is divinely mandated, it doesn't degrade their importance at all. And, of course, the objection that I'm kind of anticipating from you is coming from the subjectivism or the relativism idea. You know, okay, that's all fine and good, Matt, but what makes your moral code better than mine? And that's where my empiricism jumps back in and say, where's the evidence that your moral code is better than mine? That's why it's important to discuss ethics. And, you know, you can test an ethical creed on the basis of, you mentioned it first, utility. Does it work? You can test it on the basis of happiness. Does it make you or others happy? You can test it on, does it help people? Does it harm people? How many people does it help? How many people does it harm? You can test it on the basis of your experience. Has it helped before? Will it help in the future? What can you base off of that? You can test it on the basis of, is it a practical moral creed? Because there are just some moral creeds out there that are they're not very practical at all. And you can also talk about whether it's a realistic moral creed. So, is there an objective morality? It's possible. I mean, it depends on what you define as objective. I would lean towards a biological objectivity in a way, but I think all moral codes, all of them, including theistic objectivism, they're flawed. So, I don't know if you can necessarily point to an objective moral model. I think it points more to the recognition that morals are man-made ideas that recognize certain truths and imperatives, and they try to explain them. You know, there's no perfect political model, so I don't think there's going to be ever a perfect moral model. As for me, I reject divinely mandated morality, at least from like the Christian perspective, because I understand that morality is discovered, it's debated, and taught. All you have to do is look at just a feral child who has no understanding of ethics at all, and you get the idea that there's not really much there that's innate. Every individual is taught a moral code, and when of age, they choose their own. And I'm going to pick on Christianity a little bit. I think Christianity itself is a very strong evidence for this, because Christians do cherry-pick their own morality.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
to some extent.
I know, but probably for different reasons. Yeah. Not every Christian follows Jesus' words, and like I said, this is strong evidence that Christians themselves play the moral game. And this is a huge reason why there's so many different denominations. But individuals, they do what everyone else does. They pick their own morality. Every human being alive picks their own morality. But to show you just the example of Christians, how they cherry-pick their own morality. Jesus said, don't plan for tomorrow. You know, he said, turn the other cheek. He said, don't marry divorced women. Love your enemy. Don't pray in public. Do not judge others. How many of these things do Christians, or anyone else who reads it, willingly stick to? I don't think the Sermon on the Mount's a good moral code. I don't think it's a really good idea to turn the other cheek. I think you should stand up for what you believe in. I promise I'm almost done. I also have a problem with theistic objectivism because God definitely contradicts some of the moral codes that he lays down in the Bible, and he does some very abhorrent things. You know, and I've got examples if you want to go over them. But I guess I'm more of a moral realist that accepts consequentialism. You know, and you can adopt any kind of ism that you want, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the vast majority of people are moral. The thing that Christianity does that I think is very damaging is that it teaches that people are fallen, that people are broken. Humanists completely disagree. We look at the good in humans, and we see that people can be moral independent of God. So why, you know, you might question any kind of ism that I adopt, I think the evidence strongly outweighs there being a theistic objectivism, at least for Christianity. Could it be something else? I don't know, but not Christianity.
Yeah, okay.
I gave you a lot to work with.
Make the clarification. You brought up the point about what objective is and subjective. I think that those really are the only two options, and maybe I didn't clarify exactly what I meant by that. I guess when I say objective morality, what I'm meaning is that something is true in all times, for all in all places, for all people. So it is maybe transcendent. It's outside us, above us, and authoritative over us. Mm-hmm. So something is right. So you mentioned earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are moral imperatives, and you say that we discover them. So I'm assuming that you're affirming that there are things that are objectively right or wrong. Is that a fair characterization?
I said that in the context that the only ones that I personally recognize, they have a biological basis. Because anytime you can play the hypothetical game, you can show that murder is not necessarily, or that killing someone is not necessarily the wrong thing to do, if you can posit something as, you know, quote unquote, a greater evil. But you get my point. Whether something is right or wrong, you can start playing around with hypotheticals that show that being an objectivist, you have a really hard time addressing some moral conundrums.
Yeah, so would you say that there are imperatives, moral imperatives, like things that I ought to do or should do because it is objectively right?
Okay, first off, I'm going to want to say that the version that you guys are listening to right now is very much the shortened version, because Jordan and I did have this discussion for roughly half an hour or so we had to cut it down quite a bit, and I'm going to concede in this part the points that he made. Basically, when it comes to morality, I personally think that there are sometimes biological imperatives. You may not even be able to call it an imperative. Sometimes I just, you know, it could just be good evidence that I use in backing up why I think you should or should not do something. Now, words like ought and should, I think, and this is where I concede to you, that in some form you can say, yes, it is kind of an opinion, in that if you think I should do something and you can enforce it, that I'm supposed to be coerced into doing something. But I think that completely misses the point of having an ethical conversation and having a good reason for supporting your ethical decisions. Humanists, usually whenever we discuss ethical precepts, we don't appeal to an objective idea of who said this and why is it 100% right. I think you'll meet very few humanists who are very much 100% right or wrong on a lot of ethical questions, because you start playing with hypotheticals, like I said, and objectivism kind of falls apart. However, I am okay in admitting that in some ways morality is relative in some ways. But this is where ultimately, Jordan, you and I disagree. You have kind of a viewpoint, it's a biblical viewpoint that man is fallen, that man is sick, and that man can't take care of himself. And like I've said before, humanists, we see the good in people, and we recognize that we have to build some kind of moral code out there that we can back up. And what we find to be moral, and we do enforce this morality through institutions such as, you know, policing, through the state, through social institutions, etc., but the way that we figure out what this morality is we discuss it, we debate it. One of the most important things that you can ask a person about a moral imperative is not who said it, but why is it right? Why is it wrong? Because when you compare any two moral incentives or moral decisions, one probably is going to have better evidence to go with it than the other. And that's where I'm coming from. Now, to grant the points that you have made, yeah, essentially, it is, in a way, one group of people enforcing their will on another. But isn't that somewhat what we do with politics? I would wonder why it's a bad thing. And I understand your position. Ultimately, we fundamentally disagree on this. And in the original version of this podcast, I hemmed and hawed for a while about it, and I had a hard time answering the question. And one of the good points that Jordan made is that biology cannot be just one determining factor on the moral question, which, again, after some hemming and hawing, I agree with him. So my biological basis as morality, I concede to Jordan, it's not so much a good basis, but it's something that cannot be ignored one way or the other. It's not the basis of the imperative. And that's a point that I freely grant him. And I still do have a hard time dealing with morality, not from an objective level, but that's something that I'm continuing to study. So Jordan made a lot of good points. We'll have to get to the point where we're going to be wrapping up the podcast, but I'm going to be allowing him to make his objections to what I just said.
But I guess, again, all you're doing is pushing the question back and creating another standard that you're measuring everything against. And I would just ask you, where does that standard come from, and why should I accept your standard there?
Why you should accept my standard?
Yeah,
because it's all that we have. Why? That's all that we have. We only have our human standards that we can deal with morality. I mean, to me, if you try to apply some kind of objective standard, especially a theistic objective standard, you're special pleading that some standard that you stand by has some kind of authority just because God says so. I mean, I understand what you're doing. You're poking holes in my particular type of ism, the morals that I go by. That's fine. I can turn this right around and say, well, what about yours? Because if you live your objective standards according to the Bible, well, I mean, if you look at the Bible, God himself, I mean, he changes his moral code time and time again. And he also commands his followers to break the moral code that he set, the objective moral code. I don't know if necessarily poking a hole in the moral code that I choose, which I freely admit, no moral code is perfect. I don't think it necessarily builds a case for objective morality. Because if you look at stuff like, you know, thou shalt not steal, of course, then you have Exodus 3:22. God gives them the command to plunder the Egyptians. And you can look these up at your own your own will. You know, Exodus 3:22. Of course, God says, thou shalt not kill. And then you have examples in the Old Testament where God says, all right, kill them. Yeah.
Slaughter the Canaanites.
Well, no, and also your own people. And then, you know, you have imperatives that say, don't make unto thee any graven image. But then what does he tell them to do in Exodus 25:18? Build me an ark. I want two cherubims of gold. So, you know, I can just as easily poke these holes in your objective morality as well, especially coming from a Christian point of view, because if you look at the Bible in terms of moral codes, it is very, very contradictory. And this is taking into account the understanding of what was moral for the Jews versus what was moral in the New Testament versus what was supposed to be moral for the Gentiles as well. I understand those subtleties between different types of moral instructions for different people, but those contradictions in moral code still exist. And I guess to kind of sum it up, you know, we both have problems with our moral codes. You know, my moral code, it suffers from a lack of authority. And, you know, there can be problems with understanding how we build our imperatives. Again, that's something I freely grant you. And in the original version of this podcast, you know, it's something I had to admit. But also, I kept in at least the elements and the gists of some of your objections. But at the same time, I think your moral code has problems too. Once again, just to clarify, I don't think any moral code is perfect, but we have to work with what we have. And right now, we're just comparing our respective moral codes. And I hope, you know, both of our audiences, they think about the moral question in such a way that they go research these moral issues on their own.
What I'm trying to point out is that if it is the way you say it is, that we all form that, and let's say, and I guess assuming an atheistic view of the world, there is no God, then at the end of the day, that there really is no right and wrong. It's basically, at the end of the day, really it comes down to either majority opinion or whoever has the most power, and or it's just whatever your preference is. But whoever enforces the code, it's ultimately whoever has the most power. So, you know, really at the end of the day, we can't object to what Hitler did. We can say, we don't prefer that. We think that's bad. But we really have no grounds for saying that's wrong.
I think on the moral issue, you and I are probably just going to end up disagreeing that, you know, fitting it into your worldview, I think, overly simplifies the situation. And, you know, I have to admit that I can't give you an answer that in one way or another you can't basically fit into either objective or subjective morality. So I think we're kind of at a stalemate on this one, even though, you know, again, I concede the points that you made and you've, you know, gentlemanly conceded mine. So we both obviously have problems with each other's moral code, but I think your question was a really good one, and it shows that we have to continue working out these moral issues. I mean, on that note, I mean, you do kind of get the last word, because we do have to wrap up, and as much as I could object to what you said, I fear, you know, we want to avoid going around in circles, so unfortunately we are going to have to move towards a conclusion for this podcast.
Yeah, and I pressed all this maybe to say, this can be my summary statement here, but that I think that what I'm trying to point out is that you do realize that on your worldview, there is no way to account for anything being objective in a truly objective sense. And so it is a matter of subjectivity, trying to get people to come together around certain common ideas and that sort of thing. And we agree on things and all of that. And I guess, but at the end of the day, it's nothing more than preference and the ability to muster up your army of people to go along with something. And I guess what I want to point out is that seems to be very much against our experience, intuitive experience about morality, and that things like torturing little children for the fun of it, or the Holocaust, or, you know, any of these number of other things you can think about, human atrocities, there's something that rises up in us saying that those things are objectively wrong, regardless of how I know it, regardless of how we came about, like, it's wrong. And our conversations are just laden with this type of speech when we have arguments about, you know, same-sex marriage and equal rights assumes that people should have equal rights because fairness is good, because people should be treated, you know, because they have dignity and all this kind of thing. So, like, we're just – when I say we're in a moral universe, in that sense, we're very much moral people, and everything we do, anything of significance to humanity, involves morality, and we speak as if it's objective. So it seems to me to deny that it really is, and it's more of an illusion, something we kind of treat it like it is, but it's really not, seems to go against what seems to be our everyday experience. And well, for me, that seems like a weakness for your worldview.
All right, that's fair enough. Not saying that I completely 100% agree with how you phrased it, but, you know, we'll let that objection ride. All right, so on that note, we have pretty much gotten to the midpoint of our discussion, and I'm going to call it, at least for now, a night, and I'm going to let Jordan go ahead and say his goodbyes.
All right, good night all. It's been a good discussion. I look forward to continuing it with Matt next time.
All right, and thank you for joining us, and we will let you guys listen to part two somewhere in the near future. Take care.
There's no nirvana, and that's just swell. There is no heaven in which to dwell. But the good news is that means that there's no hell. I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist, Muslim, or Jew.